Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
American Dirt was one of the hottest novels of the last decade. It was great, readers loved it, and it sold in the millions. The author, however, endured one of the biggest ever Twitter takedowns, fiercely criticising her for writing a story from an immigrant's perspective. A huge book tour was pulled. Janine Cummins thankfully survived and is in her comeback era with Speak to Me of Home, which is a lovely novel that pointedly returns to the identity themes that so enraged the online mob back then. And among those identities, I'm glad to say, are very strong Irish ones as well. Janine Cummins, welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
I would say there must have been a time 5 years ago in 2020 when the mob was raging that you might have thought, I mightn't publish another novel.
Absolutely. Maybe a year when I thought that. I mean, I just thought, why would I put myself through this again? You know, I wrote a book that I cared very deeply about a subject that I was really invested in, mm-hmm. and I felt proud of the book, and then it really upended my life and my career. So I just sort of thought, I don't know if I want to wade back into that mess.
It was also a subject that needed that novel treatment, because I learned so much about the immigrant experience, particularly the heartbreaking and traumatic journey that people were taking to get to the United States.
Yes. I mean, thank you for saying that. I absolutely felt like there was room on the bookshelf for a book like this that would put you inside the skin of the people who were living that experience. And, you know, I spent 5 years researching and visited migrant shelters, spent a lot of time in Mexico, spoke to many migrants and a lot of people who are expert on migrant issues. And I wrote a book ultimately that I felt really good about. And I think it worked. It did the job that I wanted it to do, which was to make people think more intimately about the real life experiences of migrants.
Remind us of the run up to that, because American Dirt was destined to be a massive success because of the hype and the build up and the fact that you had hit on something that the publishing world was crying out for.
Yeah, I mean, my Irish husband tells me that it was like launching a cruise ship from the top of a cliff, because it was, you know, it was a bit of a behemoth before it came out, and it really was feted. I mean, just celebrated by the whole industry. There was a 3-day auction for the rights to publish the book in the U.S. It was translated into 37 languages. It has sold millions of copies, as you said, around the world. Mm-hmm. And I just think nobody really saw it coming, least of all me, what was waiting around the corner.
At what point in the success story does the social media storm begin? You were on sale.
It was just before the on sale date. The weekend, it went on sale on a Tuesday, and it was on the Friday, really, that it all kicked off. There had been a few rumblings before that, but it really sort of exploded the weekend before.
And it had been picked for Oprah's book club. It was huge interest. It was already getting rave reviews. This was the great novel we needed.
Well, that's what they said.
How quickly do you know that you've got a very serious problem here?
Immediately.
Really?
Yeah.
Just because it was trending online? Or
I don't know why. I just had an instinct. I knew on the Friday that everything was falling apart. Like it was all coming down around my ears.
What did that feel like?
Grief.
Really?
Yeah. I remember lying on my couch and just couldn't get off the couch. It was a really horrible... it was, you know, anyone who's ever endured any kind of an online hate storm, I cannot tell you how it feels. It's just a horrific experience.
How did your publishers respond?
They were very supportive. And I have to say, I mean, stalwartly supportive. And Oprah Winfrey was heroic in her efforts to stand by me. And as were many people, there were a lot of heavy hitters in the writing world who came out and spoke out on my behalf.
The Oprah element is really important, because she put it in her book club. She was saying, this is a fantastic book. We need to read it to learn the immigrant experience. They were calling on her to withdraw it from her.
Yes.
She never did.
She did not. No, absolutely not. She said, how dare they tell me I wasn't supposed to feel what I felt when I read your book. So she is a woman who has the courage of her convictions. She is exactly who we think she is. And she stood by me, you know, in many ways. I credit her for my survival. of that time.
Did you talk to her? Did you reach out to her people or did you hear from her at all?
Oh, yes. We are still in touch.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Directly?
Yes.
With Oprah?
Yeah.
Those powerful people in the planet.
Yeah, she's an amazing lady.
Well, the key to this cultural moment, culture war moment, is that the legacy media, as they call them now, the mainstream media, decided to join in.
Yeah, that was very unusual. That was the one thing that really set this thing apart from other moments like it previously. The mainstream media legitimized the hatred.
The crux was the claim that you didn't have the right to...
yeah, that was some of it.
Right from the perspective of...
That was some of it. There was an awful lot of chatter about my identity, which is actually no one's business, you know, as a writer.
It was very cruel, wasn't it?
I mean, yes. And no writer should ever have to defend their ethnicity on a public stage. It has nothing to do with the book that I wrote.
Remind us of what they said, because you obviously had said you had Puerto Rican heritage.
As I do, and Irish. That is how I've always identified.
People were trying to say, no, you don't.
Right. Well, there was an issue because I had written an article, an op-ed for the New York Times in 2015, I think, where I identified myself as white. It was an article about racial justice and my family's experiences with the criminal justice system. And in that context, it was very important, I felt, for me to acknowledge my whiteness. But in fact, there are lots of white Puerto Ricans. And I never thought in 2020 that I would find myself in a position where I had to say, you know, Latino people come in different colors. Like, just because I identified as white in 2015 does not mean I am not Puerto Rican.
It wasn't like, this is the final, and there's nothing else.
Yes. It's like, and this is what I think where the new book really grew from. The germ of the idea was this question that started to evolve in my mind about identity and, you know, living in this moment where it's so important in our culture, especially in the United States. It's like paramount that you find the correct checkbox on a form and like squeeze yourself into that box. And it's so...
You can't be anything else, just
right,
the one thing.
Right, but which is like not how humans work, you know? Like I'm lots of different things, including Puerto Rican.
Even those of us in Ireland who are purely Irish are not really. If you go back far enough, you'll find other things.
Yes, but even with that, even if you are 100% Irish, that is not the whole story of who you are. You're also like a mother, a reader, a daughter, a sister, a writer, whatever the other elements of your identity might be. Distilling ourselves to one label is so counterproductive in terms of like trying to get to a more equitable culture.
That was the row. The toll on you must have been extraordinary. I mean, very few people have been at the brunt of such, really, it was global at that stage, wasn't it?
I mean, most of the bad stuff was happening in the United States. Mm. You know, the support that I got from my publishers globally was much, I mean, it was, and the media globally were kind of scratching their heads, like, what is going on over there in the U.S.? The toll was not great. You know, there was an extended period where I felt very beat up emotionally. But in the end, it was not my first rodeo. I've had plenty of trauma in my life. Mm-hmm. I know how to survive it. And here I am.
And you've written about it before. The publisher said that you cancel your book tour for safety concerns.
That's right.
That was true.
Yes, there were threats of violence against me.
You were in danger.
I don't know if I was ever in danger, but there were credible threats of violence.
What was your day-to-day life like in those months in 2020?
Bathrobe, couch, Doritos.
Which sounds like a lovely time.
I was just very depressed. It was I went from being someone who felt like they'd won the lottery in their career. I was the golden girl of publishing overnight to becoming a pariah in the industry.
Were you abandoned by previous friends, people who had been supporting you?
Not a lot. I did lose a couple of friendships. That was very heartbreaking to me. But most people who know who I am stood by me. There were a couple people who I learned who they were, and they did not stand by me. And then there were a lot of writers who I didn't know very well. I wouldn't have necessarily called them friends, but that was this really disillusioning and disheartening element of what went on, is that I saw a lot of cowardice in the industry. People who had previously been very outspoken about how great this book was suddenly did not want their name on my book jacket anymore, wanted to withdraw their support.
And they did.
They did.
Got their names removed. Did they publicly criticize you?
Some of them did. Yeah. And then I also would receive private emails from people saying, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening to you. It could happen to any fiction writer. This is crazy. But they wouldn't say it out loud. And I don't even blame them because they're risking their livelihood. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, quietly away from all this fury, readers loved the book.
That's right.
And it kept selling and selling. You didn't need a book tour in the end.
That's right.
And it sold in the millions. That must have felt like a win.
Yes, thank God. I don't know. I mean, my husband and I talk about this all the time. Like, where would I be now if it hadn't? I don't know. But the fact that the book continued to sell and performed in such a way that I was able to kind of put that all on the side while I worked through what was happening privately, I think the fact that the book sold so well was a tremendous benefit to me emotionally.
It also showed that the world kind of shrugs at what's going on in a maelstrom of social media and indeed mainstream media and make their own decisions as grown-ups.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't that refreshing?
It is. It just took so long for us to kind of realize that, though.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people still haven't realized it, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it's changing. Are you at peace now with what happened?
Yes. I wouldn't change it. It was very painful, but ultimately, you know, the insight that I was able to develop from enduring an experience like that was valuable.
Because this book we're talking about today would not have existed, would it, had it not been for that moment?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, the book is not about what happened, but certainly the ideas that I began to explore in the months following American Dirt, they were the questions that I began to ask myself about my identity. Am I doing it wrong? Am I doing my identity wrong?
Right,
am I performing incorrectly as a mixed ethnicity person?
You had those doubts.
Yes. I mean, I really thought, you know, I just was so confused. And I think I had probably my whole life had some of those questions, being someone who's mixed, you know, mixed heritage. Mm-hmm. I had never felt entirely comfortable learning how to articulate those things. Partially, that's my generation as well. I'm Generation X.
Yeah.
We don't have this like incredibly entitled ownership of our identity that millennials and Gen Z kids have, and like more power to them. But I was always more like, I don't really know how to say these things. I didn't have the language for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I already had those challenges, and then they were absolutely brought to the forefront by this experience.
So Speak to Me of Home is the novel. It's a lovely novel, by the way, and obviously because novels have to be entertaining, it doesn't have the adventurous thrills and kind of fears that are contained in American Dirt, but it has fun love triangles, incidences, and you've got the Gen Z characters
yes.
and their identity politics there as well.
Yes.
You had a bit of fun. I think you had a little bit of a grin on your face writing some of this.
You know, it's so great that I remembered that fiction can be fun, that writing can be fun. And it took me a minute to get back there, but I really enjoyed writing this book.
How long was the minute?
It was probably 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
For a writer, that's massive.
It is. And I mean, I did have a few false starts in between, but when I really stumbled upon these characters was, you know, I started asking myself questions, not only about my own identity, but how we got here. Mm. Like, how did I arrive at feeling the way I feel about my identity? And then, of course, the answer was like to look to the generation before me, to look to my father, who grew up back and forth between St. Louis and Puerto Rico. And his feelings about his identity were very different from mine. And then those, again, were very different from his mother's, who was born and raised in Puerto Rico. So I started to look at the three generations and to ask questions about, like, which one of these three has the most legitimate sort of claim or the most legitimate feelings about their identity. And of course, spoiler alert, the answer is all of them are legitimate. But those were the questions I was asking that led me into this story.
Okay, tell us what it's about. It focuses on three women.
Yes.
And they have fascinating things going on in their lives.
Yes.
Some more dramatic than others.
Yes. So in the first chapter, it's not giving anything away to say there's a terrible accident and we don't know for most of the book whether or not the granddaughter is going to survive, the third generation character. So as, you know, her mother and grandmother are endeavoring to rush to her hospital bedside. We come to understand their life stories sort of through flashback. And, you know, the grandmother, much like my grandmother, born and raised into extreme privilege in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and sort of grew up in a very elite position in society and then lost everything when she was a teenage girl.
Really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and it's this part is all true. That
wow,
she,
really?
Yeah, and that she, at 16, went from being a kid who had, like, servants in the house with her to being a kid who was farmed out to a naval base in Trinidad to get a job as a naval secretary.
Wow.
And that's where she met my Irish grandfather.
Yeah.
And they fell in love and, you know, her whole life changed, like, very dramatically. And then eventually, you know, they moved to St. Louis. The character in the book, who's based on my grandmother, has two kids and a challenging marriage. And so then we see scenes of her two children, their childhood in St. Louis and in San Juan, back and forth, the challenges they feel about being sort of between two places, which is, I think, also a very Irish.
For sure.
You know, yeah. My husband has a similar...
He's a Mayo man.
Mayo man, yeah, living in New York many years. So when he comes back here, of course, he's the Yank. You know,
okay.
But in New York, he's always going to be Irish, so that's the
he's never going to be American there.
That's right.
He's losing his Irishness in our eyes.
Yeah, that's
he's
right.
The Yank.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I think it's a very common situation in the United States,
yeah.
Actually, for people from lots of different backgrounds, that feeling of potentially not fully belonging in either place.
The character based on your granny, your grandmother, who marries the Irish-American husband, she suffers the prejudice of, which would have been common, I presume, to Latina women in a white world, when he goes to join a country club. That's also based on a real episode.
Yeah, that's a true story.
Wow.
Yeah, they would not give her a locker in the women's locker room. They made her have a locker in the staff room, and then, unlike the character in the book, my grandmother and grandfather belonged to that country club for years. She kept going.
She kept going.
And I'm... Like, that baffles me now, and I understand that it's my privilege of my generation to be outraged by that and think, like, I would never stand for it. Of course, at that time, what choice did she have?
That's the world. There's also a gorgeous portrayal of Puerto Rico, which I think a lot of readers around the world were not terribly familiar with. It hits the headlines when there's a storm,
yep.
As there is in this story, and also in that incident when the president in his first term threw the towels at people, and also in the election we've just had where it seemed to hit the headlines in the last week before the vote. We thought it was going to swing things. Tell us about Puerto Rico and what we should know about it.
Well, I mean, I love Puerto Rico. I have an outsider's love for the island the same way I feel about this place. It's in me. It's in my blood. Mm. I'm very familiar and comfortable with the culture, but ultimately I am American. So my relationship to both of these islands is one of a feeling of love and admiration and familiarity, but certainly not ownership, you know? The relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States is extremely problematic and remains so. I love Puerto Rican food, Puerto Rican music. I speak Spanish. I do feel like what's happening right now in Puerto Rico, especially musically, I mean, everyone's heard of Bad Bunny. He has the number one album in the world.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of other lesser known Puerto Rican artists who are just incredible. And the food is amazing.
Yeah, it gets a lot of coverage in the novel as well.
But I feel like there's something almost subversive about how much Puerto Rican culture thrives despite the economic stranglehold and political stranglehold that the United States maintains over that island.
Spanish kind of ran it for centuries and then sort of tossed it to the Americans in 1898.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that was a line that the grandmother character, Rafaela, she says this as a joke almost, like, you know, it was ceded to the United States in 1898, like a used toothbrush or something like that.
And it really sheds a light again on another place that doesn't get enough coverage, particularly because is it in the US and half of the kind of sense is that the Americans don't even realize themselves.
They don't.
That they're colonizing.
So many Americans don't understand that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. Like, it's amazing to me. And then I also frequently hear the question about self-governance, like, well, are they really capable of governing themselves,
right,
as if they are an island of toddlers.
The Irish angle is all over this novel as well. Two characters up and marry Irish people. And I love how you've figured out to describe to American readers the distinction between someone who's Irish and someone who's Irish-American.
Yes, yes. You know, it is funny. There's that scene in the book where they kind of acknowledge that the one Irish character says to Ruth, who is the middle generation Puerto Rican character, she makes the distinction between Irish and Irish American, and he's startled by this. He's like, how would you know? And she said, he says, only an Irish person would make that distinction. And she says, or a Puerto Rican, because it's very similar. You know, a New Yorican or an American born Puerto Rican person, there is a very, very big cultural gap between that and an island-born Puerto Rican. And it's something that is heavily acknowledged on both sides.
I presume your husband was a very useful person to
yes.
to create believable Irish characters.
Yes, I think so.
Trapped an American over and back. He was also there illegally for quite some time.
Yes, he was undocumented for over 10 years.
And he's a U.S. citizen now.
Yes.
But the fear of deportation, which is so real for people in his in his situation now, he's out of it. That must have been terrifying.
It is. It's an objectively terrifying way to live. You know, we had several incidents that occurred during those 10 years that sort of drove home to me the fact that we were never the undocumented family they were looking for. Like, they would, you know, kind of turn a blind eye to someone in his position, as long as he's not breaking the law or drawing attention to himself in any way. Mm-hmm. Whereas were he from Ecuador or Mexico or El Salvador, that would be a very different situation.
He's going to be profiled and singled out.
Yes.
Whereas the risk for the Irish, anyone white undocumented, is just a traffic stop, a checkpoint.
Yeah, I mean, look, it does happen. Certainly Irish people get deported. It's happened to friends of ours. And and so you're always afraid of that. But you're not in danger of just being pulled over for the color of your skin. And living in New York, where most of the police officers are, you know, their grandmother's from Cork.
Yeah.
That comes in handy.
That
you
gives
know?
You a bit of a free pass.
It does.
You mentioned the trauma that you were used to before. This is a remarkable story in an earlier book, Rip in Heaven, which is a memoir. And this is, again, about the dangers in America. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that's a memoir. It was my first book. And the story there is that when I was 16, we were in St. Louis for spring break. And my brother, who was 19 at the time, went out one evening with my two cousins. They were sisters, Julie and Robin Carey, who were 19 and 20. And they were attacked by four strangers on the old Chain of Rocks Bridge in St. Louis. And Julie and Robin were gang raped. And all three of them were thrown off the bridge. And my brother was the only surviving victim of that crime. So that book is about not only what it is to endure a violent homicide in your family, but also the aftermath of homicide and what it is to deal with the criminal justice system and the media as they kind of chew up your family.
The four are convicted. Mm-hmm. Three of them, are they still on death row? They were.
No. So all four men were eventually convicted. The oldest was executed in 2005. And then the other three, two of them were once on death row. One had turned state's evidence and testified against the others, and he received life without parole for his role. The other two who had been on death row had been commuted to life without parole at this point.
Extraordinary story.
Yeah.
Your brother wanted you to tell the story.
He did. Like, he came to me when I was in my early 20s and asked if I would write it with him. And my initial response was, no, thanks. My dad is the oldest of eight kids. We have a very big family.
Yeah.
I did not want to try to be the voice of that family. I knew that people would have lots of different memories and different ideas. But ultimately, after long conversations with my brother, he convinced me that it was a worthwhile endeavor, and I'm glad we did it.
And you got the support from the family.
We did. I mean, look, it was painful for them. Some of them, it was very painful.
Dealing with that really must have helped you when the world went crazy 5 years ago.
Well, to be sure, it was a lot of the feelings I was having were familiar. Yeah.
Familiar?
Yeah. I mean, I understood not to trust the media.
Right.
No offense.
The American media, of course.
Yes, of course.
Very objective.
But yes.
But it's a fair point to make.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that they're more beholden to ratings than they were to the facts and to my feelings.
Irresponsible reporting. It was entertainment, which it often is, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
And in this country too, murder becomes entertainment.
Yeah. Well, that was part of the reason we decided to write the book, because that story was so sensationalized when it happened. And we wanted to tell the truth as we knew it, you know, of what it was like to be in that moment.
Was the important thing to tell people what life is like after this happens and when it disappears from headlines? Was that the point of it?
I mean, there were several different points. I think one of them was just to write a love letter to my cousins to give them the details of their lives back, because they had been reduced to nothing more than victims in the media. You know, they were these two beautiful young girls who got raped and killed. There was a lot more to them than that. And I wanted to give them back some of the details of their lives. But also to sort of warn people, you know, that like no one ever thinks that anything like this is going to happen to your family. It does. It happens every day.
Yeah.
And like a lot of what went on in the aftermath, it's like a cautionary tale. Don't do the things that we did.
Such as?
Like my brother sat down and talked to the police without a lawyer present because he was innocent.
Right.
And that went very badly for him.
How did it go badly?
He was initially arrested and accused of 2 counts of first-degree murder because they didn't believe his story.
And obviously that got coverage.
It got so much coverage. And then when he was exonerated, that got very little coverage. Mm-hmm. So it was a really intense dumpster fire.
Your family's been through it.
Yes. My husband is always asking if maybe I would like to write about puppies and unicorns next, or just anything a little simpler, a little safer.
As if there was any doubt about the Irish element of your identity, your two kids, very Irish names.
Yes, Aoife and Clodagh.
Does everybody know how to pronounce those names?
No, not at all.
In New York.
No. Yeah, no, it's hilarious. They actually, their surname is Kennedy. My husband's a Kennedy. And whenever they have a substitute teacher at school, they just stumble and then they just say Kennedy, and then the girls have to. They're like, they're, but Aoife especially, she gets Awaf, Aoife, Aowife. It's amazing. She comes home with the best pronunciations.
And of course, along with the theme of Speak to Me of Home, your kids have this lovely layered cultural identity now.
They do. It's funny. I always, even though they are one more generation further removed than I am, because of the way I have returned to the roots, all their lives they have listened. They can sing any Puerto Rican pop song. They know all the Latina music. They eat Puerto Rican food. We have a lot of Puerto Rican customs in our home that I did not grow up with.
Right.
And now my poor confused Irish kid, mostly Irish kids, are like, we're Puerto Rican. So that's a whole, I'm getting them ready for therapy when they're older.
Especially after they've read this, because they're going, Mom, we're in this book, basically.
Yes.
To get to this moment, you've been through the mill, as I say, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you relieved? Are you excited? Are you nervous?
All of the things, yes. All the feelings, but I'm ready. I mean, mostly I just feel ready to have a new moment.
Well, Janine Cummins, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, but we see you for the next one.
Yes, I hope so.
But in the meantime, Speak to Me of Home is published by Tinder Press and is out now.